Welcome to episode 62 of the Robot Report podcast, which brings conversations with robotics innovators straight to you. I'm Steve Crow, editorial director of the Robot Report. Thanks as always, folks, for tuning in. You can find us on all the major podcast platforms, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, anywhere you listen to your podcast. Please subscribe, leave us a rating, give us a review. Joined as always by my partner in crime here, Mr. Mike Oitzman, editor of our robotics group. Mike, one of the best days for you last week when we found out that Indy Autonomous Challenge is coming back.
Oh yeah, Steve, I'm super excited. I mean, as fun as it was to go to Indy Motor Speedway, they made the announcement last week that we're going to have yet another challenge event. So this time, as we sort of hinted to, couldn't quite break the news that it was going to be at the CES event, but now it's official. It's coming to Las Vegas in January.
So I assume you'll be there.
I'm doing everything in my power to be there. You bet.
Is that the dumbest question I've ever asked?
And I think, you know, you had asked before, and certainly I think everybody asked, you know, when are they going to go head to head? And that's really the format for this event in Vegas. They're going to go head to head on the racetrack. I don't know if they'll have all the vehicles on the race course, but maybe at least two, they're promising at a time. And try to race. So I think this is going to be sort of that next level. And as we heard from Alex in our interview, right? I mean, he talked about the fact that they ran out of time to get to this level of coding, or at least all the teams didn't make it there. And so they've only invited five teams to come to Vegas, and they were, you know, all the finalists. Everybody that was able to make it successfully around the track. Is invited. So five teams: Euro Racing, CAST, the team from Korea, the MIT Pittsburgh RW team, and actually they were one of the teams that crashed. So hopefully their car's gotten repaired. And then Polymove and TUM. So those teams are going to be in Vegas. And one thing that I'll note for you is that they're saying you have to be a CES attendee to go to the race. So they're not going to sell, at least right now, they're not going to sell tickets to the general public to come see it. And I guess I have to go on record and say, I think that's a mistake.
Yeah.
So, you know, they had very inexpensive $10 tickets that anybody could come to the race in Indy. And I hope they would be able to do that here. But then again, I don't know, you know, what's the reasoning behind that. So,
yeah, I don't know either. Clearly it's something to do with, you know, that they're probably, are they getting the space from CES, or, you know, I don't know. There's got to be some sort of back channel deal there where it's a benefit to CES attendees. Does it help CES attract more attendees if, you know, they're able to go to a special event like this? I don't know.
Or who knows, you know, the insurance and other things, right?
Right.
About covering the event at the actual racetrack. So anyhow, I'm planning to go, and I'll come back in mid-January and give you guys an update on how things have evolved in the world of autonomous racing.
I love Vegas, so maybe I'll see if I can join you for this.
That would be fun.
That would be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Before we get to the news, Mike, and there's a lot to get to there, we got to plug our Mobile Robotics Week. For folks who haven't heard about this yet, you can check out the full agenda at roboweeks.com. Again, there's a couple of sessions per day for free if you want to learn about what's going on with autonomous mobile robots. But Mike, what can people expect to see and hear about?
Well, we've got a lot of great content and a lot of great speakers lined up. And thanks to all of the sponsors who are supporting this event. So again, like we had the last couple of months with the Robotics Engineering Week, again, which you were sort of the moderator throughout that week. And I'm sorry, Dan was the moderator for that one. And you were, you took the Collaborative Robotics Week early on. We're just building on that. And I think that if registration is an indicator, we're getting really good now at marketing this event. So again, it's going to be a great content, and, you know, come check out the sessions, sign up for the things that look interesting to you. Again, it'll be available after the fact as well, but we'd love to have live folks there asking questions during the actual events.
Yeah. Again, folks, this is all for free. you know, how to select AMRs, how to deploy them successfully. We'll be going over case studies, all sorts of things to educate you about the latest and greatest when it comes to autonomous mobile robots. And you can register again for free. Just go to roboweeks.com.
Right.
Again, Mike, kicking off our news coverage, we'll stick with the AMR theme. And folks, we have you covered with the best news and analysis of the global robotics industry with our network of robotics sites. You can check us out at The Robot Report, Robotics Business Review, Mobile Robot Guide, and Collaborative Robotics Trends. Now, this is a tough name, Mike. We're going to butcher this name. Yeah. So we got a little robotic help here from our friends at YouTube to help us pronounce this name. But basically, two German companies are coming together. Jungheinrich AG, let's hear the official pronunciation here.
Jungheinrich.
has acquired an AMR developer called Arculus. We don't have financial details of this acquisition yet, but you have a lot of the details. You broke this story earlier this morning prior to us recording this. But yet again, another AMR acquisition, the fifth one, just in the last 6 months, I think.
Yeah, it's amazing to see what's happening. And I think we predicted that we weren't done, Steve, after the last acquisition. And this just proves that there's going to continue to be more. But I think to talk about Jungheinrich and Arculus, I think this is another great marriage. You know, not in the same vein as ABB and ASTI, but here Jungheinrich is a excellent brand in Germany and in Europe. They made tuggers and manually driven fork trucks for decades now. They got into making AGVs. And so Arculus is an AMR vendor. They've been around for, I think, since 2016, if I got that right, and have developed a portfolio of autonomous mobile robots. So again, Jungheinrich has a mature sales channel. And so, you know, they're just going to pick up this portfolio and add it to their bag and, you know, begin to sell the complete portfolio to their existing customer base. And so I think it's going to pay immediate dividends to Jungheinrich organization going forward.
Hey, kudos to us for that pronunciation. That's let's hear how the robots would say it one more time.
Jungheinrich.
I think we're pretty spot on there. So that's our day is done. We can call it a day here. But yeah, I think I've never heard of this company. I've reached out to a couple of folks who are AMR users who have also, you know, based in the US, who have also never heard of these companies. But Jungheinrich is a massive company. You know, you had it in your report there, $4.3 billion US dollars in revenue last year, 2020. So they're a major player. So
a global player
based in Germany, but absolutely a global player. So, you know, along the likes of, you know, ABB, a large company making an acquisition like they did. So, you know, it's just getting started. You know, this is the fifth one in at least the fifth one in the last 6 months here. But I think there'll be many more to come in the not too distant future. Moving forward here, we're talk a little bit about autonomous vehicles again. Last week, we talked a lot about autonomous cars and robo-taxis. This week, the autonomous trucks have kind of taken the spotlight. Quickly mentioned Kodiak Robotics, a young startup out of Mountain View, California. They raised $125 million in an oversubscribed round. So congrats to them. We've had them on the podcast before, and we'll make sure that we include that link to that episode in the show notes. But really, the story of the week, not a positive one for an autonomous trucking company called Plus. They make the autonomous driving software for these long-haul trucks. They can either be retrofitted onto existing trucks, or they can be integrated into new trucks that are in the production process. But they were supposed to go public with a SPAC, another SPAC merger, and it actually fell through. It was a mutual decision with Hennessy Capital to terminate this SPAC. And in the release that they sent out, they said that it was, quote, due to outside regulatory issues outside of the U.S., is what they were saying. And it was, you know, it was pretty broad, but it was pretty easy to make the connections as to what happened. And they actually, and this was super surprising to me, you know, we reached out to them. We did our due diligence trying to get them to comment on the story. Right. And in full disclosure, I had no expectation of them actually sending back a comment. Then typically that never happens, right? And I understand that there's a lot at stake here for a lot of different people who are involved. But they wrote back and I said, hey, you know, I said, hey, you know, does that, when you say outside of the US, are you referring to China? So Plus has a large presence in China. They partnered with FAW, which is based in China, and it's the world's largest manufacturer of heavy duty trucks. They have other partnerships in China. They have two offices in China. They have major goals for China. They also have major goals and are headquartered here in the US in California, I believe. So I said, when you're referring to outside of the US, are you referring to legal issues in China? And they actually wrote back that, yes, you know, we are referring to China. Now, this is where it gets over my head. I think I said so in the article. We linked to other media outlets that are much more up to speed on what the Chinese government is doing when it comes to tech companies that have a presence in China. There's a major crackdown happening over there. A lot of folks are saying it has to do with user data, and the Chinese government doesn't want outside investors, you know, investors that aren't located in China, to have any sort of access to company data, you know, companies that operate in China. So basically that's what's happening here. And you really don't have to even understand it more. You don't have to go that far back. So basically Plus, they said they're trying to restructure parts of their business in hopes of going back to Hennessy Capital in the coming months and restart negotiations about how to make this SPAC merger happen. But just 3 months ago, another autonomous vehicle company, Pony AI, they develop self-driving cars, or the software for self-driving cars. They also plan to go public on a US stock market via a SPAC merger with a blank check company. Now, according to Reuters, the deal fell through after Pony AI, quote, failed to gain assurances from Beijing that it would not become a target of a crackdown against Chinese technology companies, end quote. So it's the same thing that's happening here. So I think, as I said in the piece, this is the second time in 3 months that an autonomous vehicle company that has a presence in both the US and China has had a merger fall through due to, you know, these new Chinese regulations that have come kind of out of nowhere, you know, earlier this year. And
well, I think, I mean, Stu, to be fair, to the companies going the other direction, you know, let's go back to companies like DJI, who,
sure,
you know, and the crackdown on data leaving, you know, the US back to China. So I think it's these companies, unfortunately, a little bit of the punching bag between the US and China in data regulations. And certainly there's a lot of things to sort out in all of this from both sides, right?
Yeah, it's an area, you know, the US and China, they don't see eye to eye on a lot of different things. Clearly, this is another
area, right?
It's another area. Reuters also reported that had the Pony AI deal gone through, they also, to your point, Mike, would have faced scrutiny here in the U.S. and that the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission doesn't want companies to, you know, Chinese companies to be able to raise money in the U.S. until they fully go through their legal structures and disclose some of the other happenings that might be taking place. But just again, final note on this one to show you some of the effects that these new regulations in China have been having on tech companies over there. SoftBank had their quarterly earnings release just a couple of days ago, and they lost $54 billion, that's with a B, in the last quarter. And SoftBank founder and CEO Masayoshi Son, he's blaming it on these tech crackdowns, and specifically how the tech crackdowns have affected Alibaba. So he invested $20 million in Alibaba 20 years ago when it was a young company. That $20 million investment grew to be worth more than $60 billion when Alibaba became a public company in 2014. But due to these new regulations in China, Alibaba was now considered to be a monopoly and have been operating as a monopoly for some time. So they were fined $2.8 billion by the Chinese government. And just in the last year, Alibaba has lost roughly $400 billion in its market value, which has caused SoftBank, you know, a trickle-down effect, right, for SoftBank. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just something to keep an eye on here, not just for autonomous vehicle companies, but, you know, to your point, DJI, what are some other companies? There's a lot happening with SPACs right now and IPOs related to the robotics industry. What are some other companies that might have a sort of a dual presence here in the US and China? And how do these new regulations impact their operations going forward? I think it's super interesting.
I think it also speaks to the whole principle of behind SPACs and, you know, as a bit of a shortcut to going public without, you know, the full scope of scrutiny that comes around a company going public in the traditional way, right? So I think this is just one more way that the governments are looking at the SPAC route and putting a little bit more scrutiny around it, right?
Yeah, if I was a betting man, I would guess this SPAC with Plus will eventually happen. I mean, there's too many people involved there that have a lot of money at stake, right? Mm-hmm. So they'll probably figure out a way to make that happen. One other story here, Mike, that certainly caught my attention, as well as others, is Gattac making another milestone in its partnership with Walmart in in Arkansas. I love Gattac. Their co-founder, Gautam Narang, was on the podcast last year. I think I picked them as one of my favorite startups of the year when you and I did that, I don't know, a month ago, 2 months ago now, whatever it was.
Right.
And again, an interesting story here. They're claiming that they're doing fully driverless middle mile logistics deliveries for Walmart. So they're taking items from a local Walmart warehouse. They have this 7.1 mile round trip route and that they go and they deliver the goods to a local Walmart neighborhood store. And then they go back and they do that. I think they said 4 to 6 times a day. They're claiming it's fully driverless. They have a really well-produced video that's out there. And there's certainly no human being behind the driver's wheel of these autonomous box trucks. There is, however, a human being in the passenger seat who has access to an emergency brake and I think some other limited controls where they can take over in case something bad happens. Gattac was very upfront. They also said that there's a chase vehicle, which we know Waymo has also used and continues to use in parts of Arizona where it's operating its robo-taxi service. So this chase vehicle is driven by a human being. And in case the vehicle, the Gattac vehicle can't resolve any, you know, some sort of challenge, the human being can get out and manually drive the vehicle to where it needs to go.
Mm-hmm.
Just thought it was interesting. You know, to me, that's not fully driverless, right? A lot of other media outlets have picked up on this. Again, I love Gattac. So we reached out to them to try to learn a little bit more information about what is next for them. How do they take that human being out of the passenger side and then make it really fully, truly driverless? Certainly, there'll be remote teleoperation capabilities built into this as well for extra safety purposes. But they got back to us and they said that they actually plan to remove the human from the passenger seat in the coming months, right? And they wanted to note that having that human in there, they're saying it's not a reflection of their technological capabilities. It's more feedback that they got from some of the local stakeholders in Arkansas. So it was that, you know, city officials, government officials, Walmart officials, you know, we know what happened with Uber with that fatal accident. If something went wrong or, you know, some sort of accident was caused by one of these vehicles, what would the fallout be from that? So just another interesting story to watch, you know, see, you know, when do they actually remove those human beings from the passenger seat? And
I think it's not just me, but there's the acceleration here of the pun intended, of the stories around how many companies are getting to the point now where they're demonstrating the technology on public roads, you know, sort of bodes well for, you know, where this is going to arrive here in the next couple of years. So it's fun to watch.
Yeah. And again, just as a final note here, we've written about this a few times when we were written about Gattac. You know, they've done some smart things. They know the technical limitations of, you know, autonomous driving software and technology and sensors at this point in time. So as much as they can, if you watch that video closely, I believe it is all the truck that they're showing is always in the right-hand lane. It's only taking right-hand turns until it gets into the Walmart parking lot. And again, that's by design. We have a story, we'll link to it, where they explain this approach. They restrict their vehicles to the rightmost lane as much as they can. They only take right-hand turns as much as they can to eliminate the unprotected left turn, which is a challenging maneuver for any autonomous vehicle to pull off. They only operate on these fixed, repeatable routes that don't have schools, that don't have hospitals, that don't have police stations, that don't have other types of facilities where, you know, hectic, unforeseen, chaos can quickly be introduced into the situation that might confuse the vehicle. So
Right. Again,
I love these guys pulling for them, and we'll continue to watch how they progress their partnership with Walmart, which is a revenue generating partnership with Walmart. But we'll have to wait and see. And again, folks, to keep updated with all the latest news and analysis in the global robotics industry, we have you covered with our network of robotics sites. You can check us out at The Robot Report, Robotics Business Review, Mobile Robot Guide, and Collaborative Robotics Trends. Up next, Mike, you had a chance recently to sit down with Samir Menon, founder and CEO of Dexterity.
Right. And this is an interesting conversation with Samir. And I think it's worth noting in part of the interview, they just in October raised a $140 million round. So as I talk with Samir, he's got a huge war chest now and they're ready to expand and grow their business. So, hey, let's learn a little bit more about Dexterity and hear directly from Samir. Welcome to the show, Samir. We've been following Dexterity since you all emerged from stealth in 2020. So I'd like you to start by telling us a bit about yourself and how you started the company.
Mike, thank you for hosting us. It's my pleasure to introduce Dexterity. Dexterity started operations early 2018. The company was founded late 2017. Mm-hmm. Its inception actually started off on the back of a lot of research work done at Stanford University. This was research to try and understand how humans move, what we could do to distill the essence of human motion into mathematical models that we could then use to mediate the transfer of human skills from people into robots. And so I spent almost a decade studying human motion. There were quite a few colleagues of mine, and we got to a point where we felt that it was feasible for us to go out into industry, productionize some of the latest and greatest advances in robot learning and advanced robot controls, in force control, sense of touch. At the same time, the field of logistics was going through a rapid transformation. Logistics has been on a very, very fast growth ramp over the past decade or so. There's a shift towards online buying. There's increasing pressure to eke out every little iota of efficiency that we can get.
Right.
It created the perfect circumstance for us to take our robotics technology, apply it to just about any robot that could serve in a function where it could automate laborious or repetitive work. And Dexterity was born. Since then, we've grown from a few folks in a garage to a company of about 150 people with multiple customers, sites operating across the East Coast, the West Coast, Japan. We've taken our robots into production, into the packaged food industry, into the parcel industry, and we're growing.
Right. And you just recently closed your, I think, Series B for $140 million. So you now have a nice war chest at your disposal. How are you going to leverage that infusion of cash?
The Series B arrives at a very exciting time for the company. Yeah. When I think of Dexterity's progress, there were the very early stages where we were proving out our technology. The next phase for us was heading into production. We've been in production for near about 2 years now. And we realized that the market conditions really demanded us to grow at a pretty rapid clip. That requires capital, of course. And we're very, very grateful for our investors to double down. Our investors include Kleiner Perkins and Lightspeed Ventures. These are top-tier venture capital firms. We had a conversation together and realized that the time was right to pump the gas. We're hoping to use this injection of capital to go out and deploy hundreds and then thousands of robots and really start to have a real-world impact.
Well, I would imagine that you're hiring, right? So just in case anybody in the audience is interested in what you're doing, to tell us a little bit about potentially, you know, some of the areas you need to fill.
Absolutely. Welcome. If you're a talented person and have an interest in robotics, we probably have a role for you. Dexterity is a very broad company. We've taken a software-first approach. So I would say three-quarters of the company is focused on building our intelligent robotics software platform. Mm-hmm. That being said, when we work with our customers, we go ahead and deliver full-stack systems that include the software, include the hardware. Our hardware is typically built by partners, including partners like Kawasaki, with whom we have a very close relationship. Mm-hmm. So within the team, we have room for people who work on advanced software, controls, machine learning, AI, who work on sensor systems, who work on hardware design, who work on integration, customer services, people operations, just about anything.
Right. So let's drill down on that question for a minute. When you describe the solution as a full stack automation solution, what does that mean exactly? And maybe how is that different from the approach of other solution providers? And maybe in that question, I would still like to better understand, and maybe some folks in the audience would like to better understand, how are you different maybe from just a classic systems integrator?
Excellent question. And I'd love to share my perspective on the evolution of robotics. So if we rewind time, robots have been around since the 1970s and the 1980s. Systems integrators have been around, vaguely around since the inception of robotics. And when we look at the very early robots, they were really all about precision and reliability. These were very, very well engineered hardware, electromechanical systems. They were extremely precise. If you want to go and weld a joint in a car or drill a hole somewhere, you take this robot, you engineer some sort of motion plan, and you implement that plan, and the robot does the same thing again and again and again. Mm-hmm. And to make this robot productive, you know, this very precise and very reliable robot, but the tricky part with precision is for your precision to be useful, the environment needs to be precise as well. Mm. And making the environment precise is one of the big roles of the commonly perceived systems integration function, where you orchestrate the environment with material handling equipment, with some sort of software instances to manage the flow of goods. And then you insert a robot, which is a single task function, or as we like to call them, STF, single task function robots. And then the robot merrily does its job, assuming everything is perfectly precise. Hmm. I think within the world of robotics, we've transitioned to an era where precision in the environment is very expensive. And while it is feasible in manufacturing to make that investment, to make the environment precise, when we start transitioning to real world workflows, like we see in logistics, the real world has enough heterogeneity and variation that this precision seems unappealing. And now we need to transition from these single task function robots that rely on precision to what we would call a full-time equivalent, or an FTE robot. Mm. When we think about how to integrate FTE robots into existing workflows, the challenge is very different. The challenge is not about complex material handling and orchestration. The challenge is about imparting into the robots a sense of intelligence, a sense of touch, different senses, human-like ability to move, to cooperate with other robots, to work alongside people in a safe manner, and to really get the job done with a highly efficient economic package that shows ROI in just about any situation. So when we think about our systems, the task of taking them into a productive work zone is substantially different from the systems integration challenge as seen in the past.
Yeah, thanks for explaining it that way. That seems clear to me now, in terms of, especially from the manufacturing history, in terms of, you know, just mass manufacturing, where repeatability is important, trying to build something the same way every time. The type of workflows that you're running into in this space, everything's chaotic, everything is differently placed. And so I can totally understand that description. But in positioning it that way, tell us a little bit then, what's your secret sauce in all of this? How have you taken that description of the environment that you're operating in and combining it with pretty much commercial off-the-shelf components like existing industrial robots to produce a solution that gives the desired outcome?
The secret sauce for us is that we've taken what we call a platform approach. And let me explain. So a common approach for startups, and this is what we see in many, many startups, is for a small set of folks to come together. They have great expertise in a focused area. They map that expertise into a product. You know, and a product over here is a well-engineered module that would integrate into a larger system to drive value. The tricky part with robotics is when we step outside the manufacturing and this precision material handling environment, the ecosystem doesn't exist. And so when we started Dexterity, we realized that it wasn't our role to build a module. It was our role to solve problems in the real world, in customer environments. And so we started off with the customers and their problems, and we built out what we call a robotic intelligence platform that really can have that full-time equivalence across a wide variety of different problems. And so our role then really centers on making sure that we can build the software that we can apply to any robot, be it a small robot picking tiny objects or a massive robot making pallets, a gripper, a fingertip gripper, a suction gripper, gripper morphologies, whether you have one suction cup or 391 suction cups, shouldn't really matter, right? And as a human being, I've pretended to play robot when I've studied robotics. One of the people I really like is this comedian Jim Carrey, and he used to pretend to be the role that he would play. And so there was this time where I just tried to be a robot, and I realized I can tape my fingers up. I can put my hand in a glove. I can literally take chopsticks and a spatula and still pick up stuff with pretty amazing dexterity, right? And so the realization there was the hardware is very important, but its importance is binary. You can either use the hardware to do the job or not. I don't see a massive qualitative distinction across different grades of hardware. And so when we think about hardware, the challenge over there is just selecting the right hardware, which is something that we can do, again, in a driven manner using our robotic intelligence system. And then we install a robotic intelligence system, and then the hardware starts behaving, picking, packing, and learning in a full-time equivalent fashion. And so that's what we bring to the table, is this platform approach where we can rapidly modify our systems to the needs of the customer. The amazing part is it always leaves the customer happy. It drives the most efficient ROI in terms of the value that we can deliver to our customers. And it's allow us to grow very rapidly. To my knowledge, I think that we're the fastest growing startup in the space.
Yes, you guys have made some tremendous milestones in the last couple of years. So congratulations and kudos to your team that. Yeah. So let's get a little bit more detailed for a minute, and maybe you can articulate for our audience some of those workflows that you're attacking. What are the areas in supply chain fulfillment space in the warehouse that you're applying this solution to?
So our first target area was packaged food, and in particular packaged baked goods. And so the question there was, for a startup like us with a platform approach where we have broad spectrum applicability, what should we choose? And we decided that we would go after something that was quite challenging, perhaps even one of the most challenging things we could encounter. And that turned out to be packaged baked goods like bread. So what makes this hard? Well, each and every bread moves a little bit differently when it's baked. It's very soft, it's fluffy, it comes in a plastic packaging that's translucent and shiny. Now, anybody who's worked on computer vision immediately knows that translucent, shiny things are pretty tough.
Right.
You have a translucent, shiny thing that's also poofy, very delicate. You can't crinkle the packaging when you pick it. You have to pick each one. And there's a common thing in the robotics industry, which I call pick and drop or suck and drop. And this is famously exemplified by a robot that you will watch. It picks up an object or uses a suction gripper to suck up an object, and then moves to a certain location and drops the object. And if you apply this suck and drop or pick and drop strategy to something like bread, you're just going to get squished bread and nobody's going to buy it. So looking at the packaged baked goods industry, we realized that we need to engineer robots that have that human level skill at picking gently, packing gently, that will, where, you know, we'll need the robots to move around. So we need mobility integrated into our systems. We'll need the robots to collaborate with other robots. If you go to our website, there are some very nice videos of the robots going ahead and cooperating to lift trays and pallets that a single robot alone couldn't lift. We have robots collaborating with people. And so putting it all together, it was a very, very challenging problem. And starting over there, we felt like if we could solve this, we could go ahead and solve just about anything else. So that was our first application area. And as we started to branch out, there's a manner in which startups think about their progress. And I'll go back to Dexterity's inception again. We're an extremely customer-focused company. Mm-hmm. So when we looked at packaged baked goods, there's some properties from the customer's perspective that we wanted to build upon. And one of them is packaged food is fast-moving. It's in and out. You don't store it for very long. You don't want to eat three-month-old bread, right? You want to eat like maybe a day or two-old bread at most.
Right.
Fast moving. It's all about distribution, right? It's not about storage and retrieval in a sense. And that's an interesting axis for us to delineate ourselves from a lot of material handling providers whose focus is storage and retrieval. And it's automated storage retrieval systems. So we were all about distribution, not storage. And we were all about that human level dexterity that has a transformative impact and not just about rote automation or single task focus robots. So it gave us a platform to mentally think about how we were going to position our industry. And we said, hey, where do you find a lot of distribution and where do you need human like dexterity after packaged food? And it turned out to be the parcel industry. So that was a logical next step for us. We made rapid progress in the parcel industry. Mm-hmm. I think by now we've shipped, must be closing on to 15 to 20 million units in production. We've lifted north of 50,000 different types of items. Our robots are in production 24/6, very soon to be 24/7, and very soon after that, 24/7 globally.
Interesting. And so from where you sit in looking at this market, what do you think is, or why do you think this is such a fertile time for automation in this space? Have we achieved any sort of threshold for either economic payback or technology that now makes this all more feasible?
The market is a very interesting market when we think about logistics. And I would be reluctant to present myself as an expert, so kindly consider this an opinion. What we've seen in logistics is a very steady transformation in an industry that has operated in a fairly consistent manner for decades. So this is an industry where processes from the 1970s, 1980s still exist. Not everywhere, but they do. Customers realize that it's time to really embrace the next level of digital and operational transformation. And robotics is a big part of it because there's a big chunk of this industry is a repetitive work that needs to be done. So there's willingness in the industry that was amplified by the coronavirus pandemic. A lot of the deficiencies and the challenges were laid bare. There was a very severe labor shortage, which is serving as an impetus to add urgency to the conversation. I think from a society level, there are demographic shifts. A lot of developed countries have an aging workforce, and so there's a shrinkage in the workforce. There are changes, generational changes in the pattern with which people perceive the nature of work. And so all combined, it's almost like a perfect storm, which makes it a very critical time for now to really embrace technology. And I think it was an excellent time for robots to go out, have a constructive and productive impact, really help resolve this labor shortage that we are seeing, make sure that we can delegate a lot of the laborious, repetitive tasks to robots and allow people to do higher value work. Mm-hmm. So it serves into Dexterity's mission. We're here to make mechanical repetition optional. And I think it's really exciting times.
Right. Then looking forward, how do you think about the future of warehouse robotics, and how can we maybe better understand, you know, the future of this application space? Are you sort of looking at ways to characterize automation and automation opportunities looking forward?
Absolutely. When we take a technical program of the kind that is going to be required to achieve operational transformation in warehouses, it's going to be a decade-long effort at the very least, perhaps longer. And we looked around to see other examples of long, complex technical programs, and the autonomous driving industry had a very good example. And what they converged upon is a set of levels of autonomous driving sort of intelligence.
Right.
You know, it was a 5-level program, and we came up with a similar one to make our conversation with our customers more constructive. And so it's a 6-level program here. Level one warehouse intelligence is what we would call classical automation. These are robots, very similar to the pre-programmed robots in the factories in the 1980s. You program them once, they do their job again and again. Fantastically precise, fantastically reliable, need a lot of systems integration to do their job properly, need a lot of environmental precision, and that's great. Very productive in some situations. The next level up is what we would call level two. Level two is a massive step up from level one in that we start to add some intelligence to the robot. So we could typically begin by adding some computer vision so that the robots can see items. Mm-hmm. So we transition from a pre-programmed robot that is single task focus to now a smart robot that may be collaborative, but still is single task focus, right? Has a slight adaptability built into it. And these single task focus robots deliver, in my mind, are an expression of an existing mindset. And so level three is where we start to change the game a little bit. This is single task function robots are like computers before the internet. Each one operates by itself in a fairly well-contained manner. At level three, we unlock the team, right? Kind of like inventing the internet, where the robots are not connected to each other. They talk to each other, they communicate, they load share, they can ask each other for help. If a robot finds an item that's too heavy for it to lift, it can say, hey, other robot, come help me out. And then the two of them could lift the item together. And so you can imagine there's a pretty sharp increase in the level of technical sophistication between level two and level three robots. And so we've put level three systems into production, but it doesn't stop there. When robots are just collaborating with each other, our vision is to make sure that the robots are constructive collaborative helpers within a workflow. And so the next level up from level three is level four, where now the team includes people that the robots are interacting with. This adds very tricky problems of ensuring safety, of ensuring efficiency, where you optimize the robots. If robots optimize for themselves, they often operate in a pretty robotic manner, and they can, you know, really make life difficult for a person who's operating them or interacting with them. So thinking about the joint team includes a model of the person in a manner that would maximize the effectiveness of the person working together with the robots. We've put level four systems into production as well and been there at least a couple of years, especially with the robots moving around. It tends to be a pretty complicated challenge.
But before you go on to the next level, I want to just ask a clarifying question about level four. Is that sort of the difference between a guarded and unguarded robotic application, sort of moving more into the collaborative element? Is that a defining element of what you describe as level four?
Yeah. At level three, you know, the robots are still living in the robot world. And in level four, you know, we tear down the wall and let people in.
Okay.
And it becomes a whole lot more complex.
Okay. So go on.
Yeah. So at this juncture, you know, now we have robots working alongside people in a constructive way. Mm-hmm. And we felt that, you know, we really needed to go back to our customers to ask them, hey, what do you want once you have systems like this? And the answer that we got from our customers was to say, hey, look, you have a great new set of capabilities that we didn't imagine before. Till now, when we were designing our warehouses, we would typically design our warehouses from the perspective of, hey, I can buy some conveyor belts, I can buy this material handling equipment, I can buy this really precise robot. Now I can rethink my warehouse, leveraging my existing workflow and really cut costs. And so level five is what we call warehouse level transformation, where we massively reduce costs, we massively reduce the operating footprint, the efficiency in terms of distribution that we can realize within a certain form factor, and rethink the warehouse, but now from the perspective that, hey, we have access to flexible, intelligent robots, not just rigid, single task focus automation. So that's what we call level five. And now we're at the level of the whole warehouse. But customers of ours, these are large multinational corporations, they operate global networks. And so level six is finally where the game changes from just being about the robots themselves to actually having the robots serve as constructive tools within the purview of a fully integrated supply chain. Let me explain. When we think about optimizing a supply chain, there are many questions: where to send goods, how to send goods. If I want a good, how much time is it going to take for me to get it? And to date, there are a lot of software systems that try to achieve operational transformation at the supply chain level, but those software systems just track, right? So they keep a track record of what is supposed to be happening. Hey, I have a truck full of items going from A to B. Yeah, my warehouse management system tells me I have a truck of items that should be going from A to B. Does the truck actually make it? Like, do some items get destroyed along the way? Nobody knows. Transitioning from a mindset where supply chain software is all about observing, tracking, and analyzing to also acting, right? And this is a big step, and this is what level six robotics operational transformation gets you, is that, oh, I have an order, I'm missing a couple of items. Well, guess what? Instead of just sending an error message, the robot can go out and physically take this incomplete order and flag it to move it to a different location. Or they can maybe fill in an alternative item. We can get much better visibility. I need to pack up a truck and send it out. I don't know. It could take 3 hours. It could take 6 hours. With robots in there, I know it's going to take 4 hours and 42 minutes. So I don't need to have the truck driver waiting. There's a wide variety of things that we can start to unlock, and we're pretty excited about this. I think, like I said, we put level three, level four systems into production. Our first level five systems are coming online as we speak. Level six is probably years away, but it's going to be a major value driver for pretty much any large multinational customer.
Yeah, always good to have another hurdle or goal to drive towards, right? So I can appreciate that. I think lots of folks can appreciate that vision for where this industry evolves to. And so I got one last question for you here. And I have to ask this for the half of my audience that's interested in mobile robots. And I haven't seen or heard you talk about mobile robots in concepts that you've just described in overall handling, but we know their value in moving goods around a warehouse and throughout the distribution logistics cycle. So what are your thoughts about how mobile robots fit into everything that you've described to us? And is that part of your future as well as things evolve, or is that going to be based on customer demand?
Mobile robots are a fantastic technology. I feel like robot mobility, really started in earnest early 2000s. It's been two decades. Mobile robots, by the way, are not just about warehouses. We see autonomous cars, mobile robots, autonomous leaf blower, lawnmower, window cleaner, they're everywhere. And the amount of progress is staggering and mind-blowing. And congratulations to everyone who's worked on robot mobility. We absolutely love it. I think when we think about robot dexterity, for us, safety was a big challenge. Speed and ROI was a big challenge. And so our initial mobility systems were focused a little bit on rails, where the robots, are guaranteed to stay on the rail. They don't run off anywhere. So we can guarantee safety very easily. And so that being said, I think mobile robots are definitely in our horizon. We're working on them as we speak. There's a wide variety of important sort of use cases when it comes to shopping in different warehouses, when it comes to maybe even transcending the warehouses and moving from warehouses into loading docks and stores and offices and libraries and homes and Mars and beyond. And I think they're definitely there. We remain extremely bullish on the integration of dexterous robots and mobile robots. I would say it's still a few years away, mostly because there's just so much work to do.
Well, great. I would have to agree with you. And I know you're focused on some very important and critical applications, as you just described to us today. So Samir, I want to thank you for your time today and for sharing with us what dexterity is and your vision for the future. I think it's an interesting analysis and description of what the market needs and how you're designing solutions to help fulfill those customer requirements. So once again, thanks for joining us today.
Mike, thank you so much. And while leaving, I would just leave us with a vision of the future. When I was a kid, I was thrilled with robots. I think growing up, I read science fiction, and I got into high school. There were no robots. I got into university. There were no robots. I started my PhD at Stanford. There were still no robots. At some point of time, I was like, all right, we got to do it ourselves. But I sincerely believe in our lifetimes, we're going to see a future where a lot of mechanical repetition is really optional. If we want to do it, great. If we don't want to do it, the robots can do it. And I would love to see that future. And we're really excited about it at Dexterity. Anybody out there, if you're excited about this this future, please get in touch. There's a lot of open positions and we'd love to have you on board.
Great. Thanks again.
Thank you, Mike.
He's got a lot on his plate at the moment. They are getting ready to grow. I think this is an interesting area of an application for robotics. They're not using mobile robots yet, but clearly, sorting things and getting everything lined up, the types of applications that they're deploying robots into is a critical part of every warehouse. And I think they've got a huge market in front of them.
For me, you mentioned, and I'll tie this back into the autonomous vehicle discussion from before, you made a note of how rapidly or how many more of these companies are on-road testing seems to be happening. We've been doing this for a long time, perhaps me more so than you, keeping an eye on some of these robotic picking companies, right? Mm-hmm. Right hand robotics has probably been around the longest of anyone that comes to mind. Ambi Robotics had them recently on the podcast as well. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to see how quickly Dexterity has grown, right?
Right.
And, certainly showcases a need for that. So, thanks again. Great interview, Mike. Thanks again to Samir Menon, founder and CEO of Dexterity, for joining the podcast. That's going to do it, folks, for episode 62 of the Robot Report podcast. We do want you folks to leave us voicemails. Come on now. We need to get you guys involved in the show. If you want to ask Mike or I a question, talk about the year, we're closing out the year here. If you want to share your favorite memories from the robotics industry in 2021, things that you're looking forward to in the industry in 2022, please, we want to hear from you. We want to get you involved in the show. You can leave us a voicemail at therobotreport.com/voicemail. You'll see a little widget right on your screen. You can leave us a voicemail right from your phone, right from your computer. Super simple to do. So please get involved, therobotreport.com/voicemail. New episodes of the Robot Report podcast drop each week. You can find us on all the major podcast platforms, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, anywhere you listen to your podcast. Please subscribe, leave us a rating, give us a review, tell your friends. And on behalf of Mike Oitzman and the entire crew, I'm Steve Crow. Thanks again, folks, for tuning in. We'll talk to you again next week.